Welcome to this special spin-off audio program developed from a satellite CME symposium held at the Society of Gynecologic Oncology's 2019 annual meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Kathleen Moore, who participated in the symposium, to review the topics and cases discussed, including audience polling data, and to obtain her perspectives on the clinical management of patients with ovarian cancer. To begin, I asked Dr. Moore how she approaches genetic testing for patients with newly diagnosed disease.
When we're talking about testing for ovarian cancer, the most important thing, I think, right now is to test something. So all the guidelines agree that 100% of women should be offered genetic testing, which really relates to germline testing. And so we are, in the United States, even with all of our resources, nowhere near 100%. So I think one of the most important things that's come out of the approval with SOLO-1 and all of this discussion of somatic versus germline is just that people, physicians and patients, are more aware of the fact that they need to be tested and they're requesting testing. And so we're seeing results rise. The most cost-efficient, accurate way to test in the United States operationally, I think, is just a huge question and remains to be determined. There's so many different kind of payer models. I don't think it's one size fits all. Certainly, the most accurate way to go would be to start with a germline test. And then if that is negative, reflex to a somatic test. Because in that way, you're not risking missing anything. But that's an expensive sequential sort of testing strategy. It's been suggested, there was an abstract presented at SGO that suggests that if you start with tumor testing, somatic testing, and then if you find a BRCA mutation or a BRP1 or one of the other high penetrance genes in the tumor, then you reflex those patients to germline testings. You're only germline testing and hopefully genetically counseling that group of patients. And then if you're negative, you don't refer them.
But you actually, when you take that approach, and I remember first time I heard that was SGO a couple years ago, you kind of leave it up to the patient whether they want to kind of explore their family hereditary thing, but you get the information you need to treat them.
Correct. And that's true. So it does give you the information, especially now with the SOLO-1 indication, to treat them, offer them treatment with a PARP inhibitor as maintenance. I do think we have to acknowledge the elephant in the room, though, that somatic testing does identify germline mutations. And so there is an element of counseling that really has to go into somatic testing that I think we sort of gloss over. So if patients say, well, I don't want to explore my family history, but I want to know if I can get a PARP inhibitor, if I have a BRCA mutation, and you identify this somatic mutation, there's sort of this like uncomfortable silence that you're left with in not taking the next step with that patient and identifying whether this is germline and whether or not her family members could be impacted. So that's one of the challenges, I think, with that approach. The other challenge is that when you just start with a somatic test and you are only going to reflex to germline if you find something, you miss about 5% of germline mutations, mainly because you miss large rearrangements in the BRCA gene. They don't show up on the somatic test as easily. And then the different somatic tests have different call coverage in terms of what they're calling mutations and different ways they categorize variants. So the combination of that can result in you missing about 5% of germline patients, which right now in an era where we're not even testing half of patients, I'm okay if we do either of them and get, you know, up to 90%. That would be amazing. But if you're thinking about operationalizing testing like within a big health network and saying this is how we're going to do things and it's impacting a lot of women, you really have to keep in mind that if you are going to do that reflex, you're going to miss 5%. And then you lose one of the biggest benefits of testing, which if you identify an affected woman, you can offer testing to her family members and do preventative interventions so she doesn't get or he doesn't get breast cancer or pancreas cancer or ovary cancer down the line. So I think it's still an area in flux, but the fact that we're having the conversation means more women are getting tested. So I think that's a good thing.
So yeah, that really struck me about this thing about missing that 5% because, you know, relatively common disease. I mean, lung cancer, we're looking for things that have 1% of lung, you know, we're looking for MSI all over the place. So that's a substantial number. And you know you're missing stuff if you only do germline, for sure.
Right, you miss the 7% that have somatic For sure.
Right. So I don't see how this is not eventually going to lead to somehow you need both or at least one, and if it's negative, the other. But I guess maybe that's going to take a while to shake out. What do we know right now about what's going on in terms of testing in the United States and community-based practice?
So I think the numbers are pretty embarrassing. Depending on what survey you look at, it's between 30 and 50%.
That's what I remember. That's incredible. That's incredible.
So we need to be 100%.
I mean, it's just surprising because, you know, when I see other biomarkers that have infiltrated into the field, you know, of course, it is primary medical oncologists, but at least at this point, it seems like stuff gets picked up fairly quickly. I mean, in colon cancer, you got, you know, RAS testing and BRAF, et cetera, and it seems like people pick it up. I don't know whether gynecologic oncologists are maybe a little more isolated to the concepts of testing, but when you look at those hazard rates in Solo 1, it's scary to think about somebody getting missed.
Oh, I totally agree. But I do think the difference is that I think we're going to overcome that difference now with somatic testing, of course, being allowed for that indication with breast. And where, of course, genetic testing in appropriate women is very important. But lung, for example, because of the just sheer volume of lung cancer, unfortunately, we've done been able to do a number of studies in small molecular subgroups. And so we know what those predictive biomarkers are. So those are just routine. Like, you don't even have to ask for it. The pathologist gets a lung cancer and they run the tests that need to be run so that you can align your patient with the correct therapies. It doesn't require a genetic counselor. It doesn't require the sort of all that extra step. In some places, you can't order a genetic test without having the patient seen by a genetic counselor first. And so that's sort of a barrier. So that's where we were with BRCA testing and ovary cancer for a long time. But now that next generation sequencing has made somatic testing so much easier, and we have an indication that really mandates you know that information in the front line, I mean, I can see a day where it just becomes routine to look at this when you get a diagnosis of ovary cancer and you don't have to like stop and ask and think. Like, it's just, here's your high-grade serous and she's BRCA positive or she's BRCA negative or she's whatever. And that just comes out in the synoptic report on your pathology. I mean, that's, I think, where we need to be so that it's, you don't even have to think about it. And that's where lung cancer is because they have more targets than we do. So
the paradigm is firmly established. Yeah. But again, you know, you look at CLL, you know, there are a lot of things where that's happening right now,
right,
at least in medical oncology. One other sort of generic issue, and I've been fascinated by at least the effort I heard at Memorial. I'm guessing it might be other places, but I first heard about this from some people at Memorial about, because as you mentioned, you have this huge issue of, do you send them to a genetic counselor, particularly if they have no family history? And what I had learned from some of the people at Memorial is they now have a video sort of consent, and they hand an iPad to the patient in the waiting room, and they look at the video, and they communicate the information that they think is essential just to go to that first step of whatever it's going to be, NGS or germline, et cetera. They try to explain it. And I'm just kind of curious what you think about that idea. Do you think it really needs to be a person? Or at least in terms of this first step, do you think some type of video or patient education model would work?
I think that in an ideal world, we would be able to counsel patients. Because I'll tell you, the information that the genetic counselors can provide and the questions they can answer from our patients are just beyond really what the vast majority of medical and gynecologic oncologists can handle. We can handle quite a bit, but they just do a better job. But there's just not enough of them. And so kind of baseline, some counseling is definitely required. You just can't send this test like I'm sending a blood test and I'll tell you what I find. There is counseling that's required. And there's nice data. The Memorial data you quoted is nice. There's actually even from more community-based practices like the West Clinic in Memphis has done really nice work on point-of-care video counseling for BRCA testing and then kind of followed up with patients to see, you know, what they took from that and did they feel they were appropriately counseled. And they've demonstrated that it's efficient to do in their clinic, that patients appreciate it and they get the information that they need to make an informed choice about testing. And it doesn't require a separate appointment that often is sort of the stumbling block where we lose patients for testing when they have to follow up, you know, 6 weeks later. And there are other examples in both academic and community settings, busy GYN oncology practices. So I really like that. I think that if it could just be standardized so that every practice isn't having to kind of reinvent their wheel and create their own, that would be very useful and widely adopted. So I really like that. And I think we have enough data that patients find it adequate in terms of their initial counseling. And then if you find something, of course, they have got to be seen by a certified genetic counselor.
Right. What about the idea of sort of telegenetic counseling? So you sort of FaceTime, webcam type thing, are those type of services available?
They are available. They're definitely available. Any kind of telemedicine can also be very useful. And again, patients find them very informative, especially when they have the nice technology where they can actually see the genetic counselor. And I think genetic counselors actually like doing that. It helps them reach more people. I think the unfortunate barrier to that really being widely available is just the ability to pay the genetic counselors for that service. It's just not something they can bill, which is ridiculous, but that's just sort of where we are. So if that could be overcome, then I think that would open up genetic counseling across many oncologic and non-oncologic disorders so that patients could get access to the counseling that they need.
All right, let's go into the next question that we asked the audience, which was, we actually just quizzed them about what the hazard rate was in the SOLO-1 trial that you reported, but I wanted to just sort of start with that question because actually it's interesting because, you know, we said, what's the hazard rate that was seen in SOLO-1 in terms of risk reduction for progression? I think the answer was 70%. You know, the hazard rate was about 0.3, and yet only a quarter of the audience actually knew that answer. But, you know, sort of taking it to the next level from a numeracy point of view, I'm kind of curious if you could describe a typical situation where you see a patient post-op who's had debulking surgery, and in your mind, and I don't know whether patients actually ask you this, I would think maybe a lot of them would, when you see a patient, let's say they have optimal debulking or maybe they have suboptimal debulking, in your mind, at least before SOLO-1, globally, what were you thinking about the risk of progression and death over the long term in those patients just with the available tools, specifically chemotherapy with or without Bev?
Well, I think a lot of oncologists are optimistic, and I do mostly phase one studies, so I'm very optimistic. I always think things are going to work. But even so, in advanced ovarian cancer, my expectation for the vast majority of my patients was that they would recur. There's about a 15% rate of disease-free long-term survival, and long-term's not 5 years for ovary. Long-term's like 7 to 10 years, where maybe you can talk about cure. But the vast majority of patients are going to recur. And so, you know, when I'm thinking about patients in the front line, I'm thinking about that fact that they're going to recur and I'm going to need other therapies, but I'm also thinking about the fact that my best chance for improving that and really maximizing whatever time they get off chemotherapy is to optimize what I do in the front line. Like, that's really where you can impact how patients do down the road. So I think clinical trials are key. And so we are at our institution are big proponents of enrolling patients to clinical trials in the front line. So we get access to cutting edge therapies such as PARP inhibitors. So a lot of my patients had access to PARP inhibitors long before they were approved for BRCA. And a lot of non-BRCA patients have access to PARP inhibitors. So we'll see where that story goes. Bevacizumab, you know, was just approved in the U.S. in frontline last year, but, you know, patients at our site have been using that for a long time because they've been on clinical trials. So that's really how I tried to optimize outcomes for those patients. Now that bevacizumab, or once bevacizumab was approved, I don't think it's essential, but I like that option, and I would talk about that with patients, especially those that were suboptimal or stage four, quote-unquote, high-risk patients. But truthfully, all advanced patients are high-risk, so I don't really separate out based on debulking. They're all high risk and risk for recurrence. So I think that talking about bevacizumab and bevacizumab maintenance is important. And then certainly now knowing your BRCA status is critical because all those patients really should be offered a PARP inhibitor following completion of frontline therapy. I don't think there's any alternative equivalent option at all. They may opt not to take it, and that's their choice. It's shared decision-making, and you have to counsel patients, but there's not an equivalent maintenance choice for a BRCA patient.
So I just want to drill down a little bit more on the numeracy of the situation. I mean, we've done tons of projects, particularly in breast cancer. I don't know if you remember the adjuvant online model that was out there, and particularly breast cancer, people would come up with numbers to try to give to patients. You know, so I know you can't take it too far, but I'm just kind of curious, again, if an educated patient asked you this. So you've painted a picture of a situation where, you know, maybe 85% these people are going to recur and die of their disease. How, in your mind, is at this point, is that altered by the use of olaparib in patients with a BRCA germline mutation? How do those numbers change? Do you think that it changes sort of the tail of the curve, for example?
I hope that it does. And I think the primary analysis, the PFS analysis, really makes a strong statement to that effect. When you talk about sort of the numbers with patients, in the past, pre-SOLO1, we had no prospective data in large numbers on patients with BRCA mutations sort of treated in a consistent fashion and followed in a consistent fashion. So there's this myth that they were this group that everybody was cured and they had this just remarkable long progression-free survival. And they do better, and that is true. But they don't do as well as I think everybody thought they did, and SOLO1 shows that. So in the placebo arm, they had a median progression-free survival of 13 months. And that's measured from the end of chemotherapy. So to normalize that to other clinical trials, maybe add 5 or 6 months. So it's 18 to 19 months, which is a little longer than you see in a non-BRCA population, but it's not, you know, forever. And it's not a bunch of cured patients. So they're very high risk, to my point. When you add 2 years of olaparib to patients who have finished and responded to induction chemotherapy, their median progression-free survival at the time of data cut point, which was May of 2018, was not yet reached. But we have an estimate of it based on some sensitivity analyses that are in the paper, but it's roughly between 47 and 50 months. So just orders of magnitude longer than placebo. And more importantly is when you look at the survival curves in the manuscript, the shape or the morphology of the survival curve for the olaparib group flattens, and it stays flat even after that 2-year mark where they discontinue whatever treatment they're assigned to, in this case, olaparib. And so you don't see patients in the bevacizumab studies, when you discontinued it, you started to see patients start recurring. Here, you stop it and the curve remains flat, and it remained flat to the point of data cutoff. So it's too early to know if we've cured patients. We've certainly markedly changed the trajectory of their disease by extending progression-free survival 1 in a very profound way. Will that convert into cures is the important question. And we hope so, but we won't be able to say that probably until 2023. But the magnitude of benefit is unprecedented.
So what was the actual recurrence rate at whatever, 3 years, whatever point you want to pick, the actual recurrence rate, not disease-free time, recurrence rate in the treated and untreated group at whatever, 3 years, whatever time you looked at?
So at 3 years, which is the point where we had the most kind of mature data, the placebo group, 27% of them were recurrence-free. So 73% had recurred by 3 years. And in the olaparib group, it was only about 37% had recurred. So it was very different in that group.
Right.
We have data out to 4 years, but there were a lot of patients in between 3 and 4 years still. So that time point's a little less mature to quote. So the 3-year mark's probably our best data to quote.
You know, when you think about it, I mean, I consider the SOLO1 data adjuvant data. Is that the way you look at it?
I think you can think of it as adjuvant. That's not a term we use a lot in GYN oncology. We like this maintenance term. But when we think of adjuvant, we think of like an endometrial cancer patient that maybe you took lymph nodes out of and they were positive.
Right, yeah.
You're giving some adjuvant with the expectation of cure.
Well, I guess the
breast cancer. Yeah.
I noticed that you all don't use that term, but in terms of the model of treating demonstrable disease. But the point I was going to make is when you think about adjuvant trials, and it's been a long time, if any cancer had those numbers you just quoted are so dramatic. You don't see that in most adjuvant trials in, you know, solid tumors. And maybe there's a 20% relative risk reduction or 30, but those are, you know, really unusually positive numbers. Just to put that a little bit in context. So the next question we asked the audience related to an issue that you just brought up, which is really it's the use of bevacizumab. And we said, okay, you have a patient with ovarian cancer. The patient does have a BRCA germline mutation. We said they had suboptimal debulking to make the prognosis even worse. But the question was, obviously everybody's going to use olaparib, but what about Bev? And actually, when we asked the audience this, I think about half of the patients would incorporate Bev in some way. Some of them would just give it during the chemo and then give olaparib. Other would give it during the chemo and then afterwards with olaparib. What about this issue of Bev, particularly in a higher risk patient, in a patient with a BRCA germline?
So that's a great question. And that is a question we get all over the country. Pre-SOLO1, the data for bevacizumab maintenance doesn't show an overall survival benefit, but it does definitely show a modest but significant improvement in progression-free survival. And a not pre-specified subgroup analysis of ICON 7, that quote-unquote high-risk group, the stage 4s and suboptimals, did have an overall survival advantage. But we have to remember that was a subgroup analysis. But certainly providers have adopted that as a standard in that group. And there's no arguing with the fact that when you add bevacizumab to chemotherapy, response rates are much higher. And so the argument that you're trying to maximize your response rate so you can get somebody really teed up for maintenance, PARP inhibitor, isn't without rationale. It's just without data. So I understand why people are coming up with this. I don't think it's dangerous. I just think we don't have data that it makes a difference in terms of how many patients you convert into maintenance eligible, at least in the frontline setting where most patients respond well enough to get to maintenance. And there was really no difference between the partial and the complete responders in terms of how well they did. And there'll be more data on that coming out at upcoming meetings. So whether you need this Bev with the chemo and then following with PARP alone, I understand why people are coming up with that, but I think it lacks some data. The Paola 1 trial, we expect to result this year. So hopefully we'll be at ESMO. That study was run around the same time as SOLO 1 and enrolled a lot of BRCA patients. They all received chemo with bevacizumab. It was a European study where bevacizumab has been part of the standard of care for many years. So they all get bevacizumab. And then once they have responded, they're randomized to continue bevacizumab maintenance or add olaparib to their bevacizumab maintenance. And it's stratified by BRCA status. So we're not going to get, unfortunately, the missing arm is olaparib alone, because they weren't thinking that way at the time. But you are going to get a somewhat of a signal of how well the BRCA patients do when you add bevacizumab. It's hard to get better than a hazard ratio of 0.3. So, you know, it may just be a drug that they don't really need. The combination may be more important in the non-BRCA patients, but I think Paola 1 will give us a little information. And if it's positive and it becomes a standard of care, then I think that's what everyone's going to flip to. I mean, that's my prediction.
Interesting.
Because it's easy. Then you don't have to think about it. You just are going to start your Bev and chemo and continue it once they're done. You're not going to have to make a choice. So that's a pretty important study coming up.
So this next question we asked the audience is another kind of the numeracy question also. And I remember I asked you at the symposium about this. And it was something I really hadn't thought about until I started to talk to these docs in practice. And then I realized all of a sudden, wow, this must be a huge issue. And it started out with a case of a woman, educated patient, who'd gotten a typical debulking surgery, carboplatin, and she comes back to clinic 1 year later and says, hey, I just heard about PARP inhibitors, and she's BRCA germline 1, incidentally. She'd had a mastectomy, incidentally. And she said, what about taking it now, a year later? And actually, the doc ended up giving her olaparib. She's on olaparib, doing well. But it seems like this would be a big issue. So my first question is, again, getting back to numeracy, you described, you know, what you consider to be the natural history or the treated history when somebody gets debulking surgery and chemo, carboplatin, very, very high recurrence or progression rate. How does that change as you go through the first, let's say, 2 years? Like, how much of that risk have you lost by 2 years? And do you think whatever that risk is going to be cut by 70% if they're BRCA germline?
Yeah, that case was hard. I get emails from providers frequently, and patients are understandably desperate to be placed on the drug when they've already finished therapy and they're sometimes months and years out. And I don't want to come across as criticizing someone else's decision, but I really don't think that we have data to support late initiation of a PARP inhibitor in someone that's been off chemotherapy and doing well for a year. You may just be kind of wasting an active drug that they may need later and not preventing a recurrence.
Well, let me ask you a question. If a typical patient comes back a year later, you said that up front they'd have maybe an 85% chance of progression. A year later, if there's still NED, how's that number changed?
Well, if you look at the survival curves on SOLO 1, you have about 50% of patients have recurred by a year. So it's 20% by 6 months, it's about 50% by a year, and by 3 years, 73% have recurred. So between 1 and 3 years, we go from 50 to 73%. So there's still maybe another 10%. So maybe by 2 years, 60% have recurred. So I think your impact diminishes.
Yeah, no, I think actually those numbers would suggest you're definitely taking a risk because, like you say, there's no data. But based on your numbers, maybe there's not that much to gain. So if the residual risk is 20%, it's still substantial. I mean, maybe it would go down to 5% or something. But in the face of an unproven strategy, that looks a little less. I always thought thinking it would be higher, but that's interesting.
I mean, I feel for folks that came in at the tail end. I don't know what to tell people. But I do think the shape of the curves tell us that the impact of olaparib is an early impact. Charlie Gourley talks about this. You know, when we talk about bevacizumab maintenance, we're talking about addressing kind of the VEGF levels and things that molecular processes that make the tumors act more aggressively. So you're really impacting on those high risk patients and trying to normalize the curves to maybe lower risk patients. This is not the case here with olaparib. It's more addressing the clonality of the tumor. So you finish chemotherapy and you are hopefully in a complete or relatively complete response. And then you prevent whatever cells are kind of always left there from starting to become more heterogeneous and that ability to have metastases that now are different from one another. So heterogeneous clonality. So if you early on take out those cells, that's why we think maybe there's the potential for cure here. And you don't see that big shoulder at the beginning of the survival curve with olaparib. So I think, and others think, that this is an early benefit. It's why 2 years may be enough and maybe even less is enough, but we didn't test that. So I wouldn't say that, but it's probably an early effect. And so adding something later down the line probably doesn't help, probably doesn't change the trajectory for that patient. And we just don't have data to support that. But it is a difficult conversation to have with patients.
You know, I think this information you're providing would be very relevant, of great interest and useful. And actually, my perception of it changed after hearing what you just said. I didn't really get that exactly when we talked about it in the symposium. One other thing, you mentioned the issue of 2 years. What was seen in SOLO-1 in terms of the fraction of women who make it to 2 years on olaparib, and what are the reasons for discontinuation?
So of the women who discontinued prior to 2 years, the most common reason for discontinuation was progression.
Right.
Very few women discontinued because of adverse events. It was about 11%.
11%.
Came off for adverse events. Yeah. So if they came off on either arm, it was mainly for disease progression.
So what was the difference in people coming off therapy in placebo versus olaparib?
So at 2 years, we only had about 50% of patients on the olaparib arm.
Yeah, I mean, putting aside recurrence, I'm just saying if you put aside recurrence and look at the remaining patients who came off because of tolerability or whatever, how does the placebo versus olaparib compare?
11% olaparib and 3% in placebo, I think, something like that. Pretty low.
Wow.
But low in both arms.
That is really low. What were the reasons in your mind, both from the data and also clinically, that people actually come off therapy? You know, the two things you hear the most about are cytopenias and GI problems. Is that what gets people to come off therapy or other stuff?
If they came off for treatment-related adverse events, most commonly it would have been anemia that was just sort of recalcitrant to dose modifications, which is really uncommon. It was maybe 3%. Some patients just chose to come off even though their side effects were what we would consider low grade. They just didn't like the fatigue or the low grade nausea. But that was also a very low percentage of patients. So it was uncommon. You know, you didn't have people coming off for thrombocytopenia or neutropenia. It was like anemia and then a smattering of patients that just had non-hematologic toxicities that were problematic.
You know, again, reflecting on other adjuvant trials, adjuvant chemo, you certainly see a lot worse numbers than what you're talking about. In any event, another issue that came up, I mentioned the fact that this case that we were talking about, the woman in the interim in the year had a prophylactic mastectomy. And a number of the docs had cases where, you know, when you have BRCA germline, well, this comes up. And one of the questions was how you counsel your patients who have advanced stage ovarian cancer and yet they have a BRCA germline mutation about their breasts. What do you advise them? Do you have patients getting prophylactic mastectomy? Do you have it with recurrent disease? And also, one of the docs brought up something I never thought about, which is, does a PARP inhibitor lower your risk of developing breast cancer in a BRCA germline patient? There are about 13 questions there.
I know. So we definitely talk to our patients about breast screening, enhanced breast screening, and the potential for prophylactic surgery when they have an ovarian cancer with a BRCA1 mutation. And I think we all practice probably a little bit differently. What I tend to do is when I see these patients and I've identified them, if I know ahead of time, which I rarely do, that they're BRCA1, I'll make sure that I have up-to-date breast screening so I'm not taking someone to the OR with a advanced breast cancer at the same time. That's a pretty uncommon scenario. Usually you find out about it later, but we really focus on getting folks through their surgery and their primary therapy. Before SOLO1, you know, they were on surveillance or maybe bevacizumab. Now they're going to be on a PARP inhibitor. So I would start talking with them when we were 1 to 2 years out. I mean, I would talk to them beforehand, but we'd sort of readdress it when they were kind of out 1 to 2 years from chemotherapy and we were feeling a little more kind of comfortable about their disease status. And then during that time, when they were ready, I'd have them meet with genetic counseling and the breast surgeons and the plastic surgeons to discuss reconstruction. And some of my patients proceed with that. I have several in my practice, and others are more interested in just doing enhanced screening with MRIs and alternating MRIs and mammography per the guidelines to keep an eye on things. They're not super interested in another big surgery. I think once folks have recurred, it really has to be individualized, because you can have someone that recurs 5 years later and you can reset the clock for that patient. She's going to live a long, long time. So you don't want her getting a breast cancer on your watch because you think she's recurred and it's not worth dealing with. You really have to keep in mind that even if they've recurred, they often can keep responding and keep responding. If you look at the study 19 data from Jonathan Lederman, there's patients on that study with recurrent disease who are 9 years out on olaparib. So you have to think a little bit differently. Certainly someone that's recurred and is not responding and is sort of going to be on some kind of therapy for the remainder of her life, I think that's a little harder to justify, you know, recommending a prophylactic surgery. But we should have thought of that a lot earlier. So I think it's important to give patients options and have discussions with them and make sure they're seeing experts. And then they can make decisions about what they want to do with their bodies. But it's important to have the discussions and not make assumptions on their behalf.
What about this question that they brought up of, does a PARP inhibitor decrease the risk of breast cancer in somebody with a BRCA germline?
I think it's a fascinating question. There's no data that would suggest that. I mean, certainly...
Is there data to suggest it doesn't do it?
I don't think we could say that either. There's just not been enough follow-up. I mean, certainly on SOLO1, of the few incident cancers that developed post-treatment, there were a few breast cancers. So some on the olaparib arm and some on the placebo arm. So I don't know that we can say that it's preventative. I wouldn't want to publicize it as a preventative measure, you know, because it does have side effects and it's not like taking a Tylenol.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I think it was just more from hypothetical. Would it work? I think it would be fascinating biologically if it worked or didn't work or if we even knew it. I don't even know. But
I mean, I think over time, as more patients are treated with PARP inhibitors in the frontline and we follow their rates of subsequent breast cancer development and compare that to sort of historical data, we may see a different trend.
Would be interesting.
Yeah.
So we had a couple cases that related to other types of mutations. We had one patient who had a PALB2 germline mutation. We asked the audience, would their approach to a patient like that, if they could, regulatory-wise, which I'm not sure they could right now, would they use olaparib a la SOLO1? And most said that either they've already done it or they would do it. Do you agree with that?
I actually do. I'm not a fan. Anyone that knows me knows that I'm not a big fan of using off-label drugs. I really think that you need clinical trials and data. So that's true. I do think that we have started to amass a nice cohort of patients from these studies who've been molecularly profiled, so we can start to make statements about some of these other mutations, specifically your RAD51C. It's small-ish numbers, but it's pretty consistent data that it is a predictive biomarker for PARP response. So I think that is one that I'm very particularly interested in. We don't quite have enough data, I think, right now for PALB2, BRIP1, you know, doesn't look quite as predictive, but still small numbers. BARD1. So there's a few others. But given the fact that they're in the Fanconi pathway, and they are, with the exception of PALB2, the others are high penetrance genes. PALB2 is maybe for development of ovarian cancer. I probably would extrapolate and try and get them access to a PARP myself. I think it's going to take a long time to generate the data with 1% mutation prevalence to show it benefits. And I don't think we've shown anything that we harm people at this point. So I would agree with the panel on that one.
So another one, the other end of the spectrum, we had a case that a doc presented of a woman who had a BRCA1 Q780E2457C arrow G, quote, mutation of unknown significance. And the question was, again, you know, we have this big bump, drop down in recurrence rate. Would you, this patient has a BRCA1 germline mutation, but it's this specific one. What about olaparib?
Unlike the other answer, I would not treat a variant of uncertain significance with olaparib. I would make sure that I knew when that test was run. Like if it was a somatic test and it was run a long time ago, I'd check and make sure that variant hadn't been reclassified. So I would make sure that that had happened. But that being said, most variants, once they are reclassified or classified as non-deleterious, meaning they have, you know, no risk to the family for familial risk, and they're not felt to be predictive biomarkers for response to PARP. So she should be treated right now like a BRCA wild-type patient, which would be observation or bevacizumab in the front line. Now, in second-line recurrence, of course, there's not that biomarker link to use of PARP inhibitors. And so certainly in that setting, you can base it on clinical parameters. But in the front line right now, I would not use it.
So speaking about the recurrent setting, of course, all the excitement was about SOLO-1, but we have to go back to some of the big questions we've had the last couple years in terms of recurrent disease, particularly platinum-sensitive recurrence. So we just asked two variations of that question. We said the patient relapsed 10 months after debulking surgery, carboplatin, so we asked people, what do you do BRCA wild type and what do you do with BRCA germline? So let's start with the germline. And, you know, really, first of all, it's a question of which PARP inhibitor. It kind of looks like between olaparib, niraparib, and rucaparib that kind of similar, maybe I would say maybe more olaparib, but you know, not that much more. And then there's also the issue of Bev. And there are people with a germline situation, we were talking before about this issue in the high risk earlier situation, who would use Bev with chemo and then even with maintenance. So what's your global strategy in a patient with a BRCA germline with a platinum sensitive recurrence? And what about choice of PARP inhibitor?
Yeah, I actually just counseled someone this morning with a BRCA mutation and platinum sensitive recurrence. So, you know, my practice is to reinduce with chemotherapy. I think the data for replacing chemotherapy with PARP is coming. And so I'm interested to see those results that should be also out this year. But right now, I would reinduce with platinum and follow with a PARP inhibitor. I really, for choice of PARP, I think in BRCA patients and probably even non-BRCA, but definitely in BRCA patients, the results across the studies, and I know cross-trial comparisons are statistically not valid, but when you look at the hazard ratios for the maintenance studies, and even if you look at the response rates when we've used each of the PARP inhibitors as treatment, they look almost identical. So from an efficacy standpoint, I really don't think that there's the best one best PARP. I think the best PARP is the one that you're most comfortable using and that your office is most comfortable dose modifying. And so you can take the best care of your patient from a safety and maintenance of dose intensity standpoint. I really believe that. They're all three good drugs. They all three work. And so whichever one people are comfortable with, use it.
How about Bev?
Bev, here, even more so than in the front line, this argument for trying to really capitalize on your response rate or magnify your response rate by adding Bev to chemo makes the most sense to me. Because really, if you use chemo alone, and GOG-213 shows us this, the complete response rates are very low in platinum-sensitive disease without Bev. You know, it's like on the 20%-ish range, and then complete and partial. And that includes partial that shrunk, but you still have a lot of disease, you know, takes you up to maybe 40 to 50%. And if you add bevacizumab to that, you bump your response rates up into the 70% range. So you convert somebody, more people into folks who've had enough of a response where they can benefit from a PARP inhibitor. So even though I don't think there's any survival data, when you look just at Bev with chemo followed by nothing, you know, those were the original studies, that didn't make any difference in terms of progression-free survival. Here, if you're trying to help more patients get to a point where you could do switch maintenance to a PARP, again, there's no data, but I actually understand that rationale a little bit more and might even try it if we're allowed from a regulatory standpoint. But in a BRCA patient who had not seen a PARP, and even in someone who had seen a PARP, I would definitely use a PARP in the first recurrent setting. I would not use bevacizumab for maintenance.
I don't know. I just started hearing people in the last 6 months use the word switch maintenance. That was the old lung cancer terminology that we use. And But technically, you're absolutely right. I guess that's really what this is. Did you say that trials are looking at the possibility of skipping chemo in platinum-sensitive recurrence in BRCA germline?
Replacing. And it's not just in BRCA germline. Solo 3 looked at a really interesting population where it was, you could be platinum-sensitive. They didn't compare it. So it was olaparib-alone versus physician's choice chemo, not including a platinum, actually. It's interesting. It's in a more heavily pretreated population of patients. They're looking at a response rate and PFS endpoint. So that data will be coming out very soon. I can't say any more than that, but watch for that. So that'll be interesting. And that's only in a BRCA population. But then NRGY004, which is being led by Joyce Liu, actually took all comers. So not just BRCA positive patients, but all comer high-grade serous, and I believe high-grade endometrioid, and platinum-sensitive recurrence, first recurrence, and randomized them to standard chemotherapy, platinum-based chemotherapy for 6 cycles versus either olaparib alone or olaparib plus cediranib. And that's based on her phase 2 data, really showing that, especially in wild-type patients, if you combine cediranib, which is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, multi-target TKI, with olaparib, at least in the phase 2, you kind of shift the progression-free survival curves to look more like olaparib alone in a BRCA population. You sort of induce BRCA-ness is the theory.
But just to clarify, in the arm that gets the chemo, they get olaparib maintenance also?
No, they do not. This was before those studies came out. So.
Oh, really? Wow.
That's going to be, I think, the bugaboo of those results is that it doesn't reflect the current standard of care, but the study was written before those came out. So
that's interesting.
We'll have to see how we interpret that data.
But still, that idea of, you know, quote, replacing chemo, I think a lot of people are attracted to the idea of, you know, PARP maintenance after platinum. Makes a lot of sense. But now really what you're saying is a different model, which is not PARP maintenance. It's kind of PARP therapy, right?
Right. If you think about it, I mean, it seems kind of scary. And we always have to be careful to not harm patients. But if you think about the response rate data, specifically from Aerial 2, which was rucaparib, because they went to the first recurrence there, just single arm study. And I remember when that came out, we were all like, huh, are people really going to enroll platinum-sensitive patients to a non-platinum trial? And it enrolled like crazy, very quickly. And the response rates in that recurrent population were over 70%.
Wow.
So these patients respond, and these were not all BRCA patients.
Huh.
So the earlier, we know this, the earlier you use chemo and the earlier you use PARP inhibitors, the better your responses are.
That's fascinating.
So is that the same, better, worse than you'd see with carboplatin? I think that's the question here. So we'll see.
Wow, fascinating. So I asked you about platinum-sensitive recurrence in the patient with a BRCA germline, but we also asked the audience about the patient, we just said, BRCA wild type at first platinum recurrence. And it was interesting because, you know, of course, this has been an issue of, do you sort of use a BEV-based approach or a PARP-based approach? And again, BRCA wild type. And at this point, 2019, it looks like people are kind of split.
Mm-hmm.
You know, about half of them go just without a PARP inhibitor and they stick with chemo BEV. And the other half go with a PARP inhibitor again, olaparib and niraparib a little bit more than rucaparib. And then there's like maybe 10%, again, try to do both some with the BEV during the chemo. What's your take on this? And again, same thing in terms of choice of PARP inhibitor. I'm guessing it's the same that you just said,
yeah.
But maybe you can go through.
I think it's the same.
Yeah. But what about whether you're going to use a PARP-based strategy or sort of a chemo-BEV-based strategy?
So I think honestly here, there's not a right answer. I think this is where you have to talk with your patient and individualize based on kind of the information you have at hand and make the best decision. So you have bevacizumab that has abundant data and modest but statistically significant overall survival advantage. If you use bevacizumab maintenance in the first recurrent setting, and that was demonstrated in GOG-213. So that makes a lot of sense. I think if you had a BRCA wild type patient, and you said, I'm going to use BEV, I mean, I think you're well within the standard of care. You also have from Aerial 3, NOVA, and then Study 19 gives us the BRCA wild type data for olaparib. You have hazard ratios that are relatively impressive for use of PARP inhibitor in a BRCA wild type population with certainly a gradation with whatever assessment of homologous recombination deficiency was used in the studies. So of course the HRD group did better than the complete biomarker negative group, but all groups benefited by a hazard ratio. So that's why you didn't have to tie a biomarker to use of a PARP inhibitor in that second line. So if you wanted to use a PARP inhibitor, I think, again, you're well within the standard of care. I tend to look at these patients, you know, and I talk to them and see what they want. Some patients want nothing to do with oral regimens. You know, there's certain decisions that are made when you actually ask your patient what they want. But everything else being equal, I tend to look at these patients, and at least at this point, I want to make sure that for patients for whom it makes sense, they have access to a PARP inhibitor, because I don't think the HRD assays have helped us really identify patients who will never benefit. And in the first platinum-sensitive recurrence, I know I can get a PARP inhibitor for everybody. If I wait and hope that she's platinum-sensitive again, she might not be. And the only patients right now that can get PARP inhibitors as treatment are those with a BRCA somatic or germline mutation. So I may miss my opportunity to use a PARP inhibitor for a particular patient. So I tend to use PARP inhibitors first in that first recurrent setting. And then I'll use bevacizumab if they're still platinum sensitive in that setting, or if they're platinum resistant, I'll use it in that setting where I know it has still significant benefit. But that's sort of what I do. Other providers do use the HRD test to try and pick who they want to give PARP to and who they don't. I don't think that's wrong. You know, I think we do the best we can to provide the most options for our patients, to have options lined up for them and not eliminate options down the line and pick the best thing for them at the right time. And there's still some clinical equipoise in this space that I think you see reflected in your polls.
So I want to go through a bunch of other questions we posed during this meeting. We got audience input in. I wanted to emphasize these topics we've talked to right now, but I do want to get your take on a few of these things. So first issue is the patient with multiply recurrent disease, completely BRCA wild type, HRD negative. Is there a role for PARP inhibitor monotherapy down the line in a patient like that?
There may be. The Quadra data in that biomarker negative group does show some clinical benefit. The response rates are very low, you know, 10%. But disease stabilization and clinical benefit out to 4 and 6 months is present, you know, 15 to 18%. So depending on whether or not you think that's meaningful for your patient, they may have a role. And sometimes when you're heavily pretreated and resistant, if you can stabilize disease in someone whose symptoms aren't causing them tremendous distress, that's really a good outcome for them. So I do think there will be a role, but truthfully, the best place I think we're going to be using PARP inhibitors is upfront, and that may be true for all patients. We'll see how these studies that are going to result this year in wild type patients pan out. If those are all positive, we're going to be using them a lot upfront, maybe one more time down the road. I think in the future, use of them in the fifth line and sixth line isn't going to make sense because everyone's going to have gotten it already. But there is probably a role at this point.
And I know we asked about the issue of which, if any, PARP inhibitor you prefer in that situation. You already stated the way you think through that issue in general. We did bring up another issue that's been out there. I think it started SGO 2018. I saw there was some more data on this. It's really interesting about dosing of niraparib. And, you know, the issue of the weight of the patient and the baseline platelet count. Can you just sort of go through that again and how you approach dosing based on weight and platelet count?
Yep. So if you remember, the NOVA trial was the first trial to result and show this really impressive benefit when you use niraparib as maintenance. But aside from the amazing responses, the other noticeable aspect of that study was a very high rate of high-grade thrombocytopenia. So you had about 40% of patients having grade 3 and 4 thrombocytopenia and quite a bit grade 4, which is hard to tolerate. That's potentially dangerous for patients. And limited, I think, widespread acceptance of that drug initially because people were worried about that. So there was a post-hoc analysis done of a number of factors, but what really came to the surface was patients who started niraparib with a weight less than 77 kilograms or baseline platelets less than 150,000 had a substantially higher risk for severe grade thrombocytopenia than those without either factor. So it was like 44% versus 13%. So that was demonstrated again in a post hoc analysis of Quadra, which was a much more heavily pretreated population that was presented this year at SGO. But impressively, when that post hoc analysis was done, there was an ongoing frontline study with switch maintenance niraparib following complete responses to induction platinum-based chemo irregardless of BRCA status, that's the PRIMA study. And that study had accrued a good number of patients, and they amended the protocol partway through and said, we're going to do starting dose based on the weights and plates analysis. So patients who met either one of those risk factors actually started therapy at 200 milligrams once a day as opposed to 300 milligrams. And those who met neither criteria started at 300. And so we don't have the efficacy data yet for PRIMA. And so that's a key point. But we've had presented the safety data for PRIMA because that study is completed accrual and is maturing, where that modification clearly shows they've brought the rate of thrombocytopenia specifically kind of back in line with the other two PARP inhibitors. So really the hematologic toxicity seen in PRIMA looks very similar to what we've seen in SOLO-1, for example. And so I think from a safety standpoint, that's great. The next question is, do you see any decrement in efficacy among those patients who started at 200? And that will have to await the results of the PRIMA primary analysis, which we hope will be out this year, but we don't know.
Although I think one of the cases where this came up that prompted some discussion about that was this patient who had a really great response to niraparib, but she had to be dose reduced down to 100. Mm-hmm. And yet, I think she was already over a year in her response on 100 milligrams. That was interesting, at least clinically. Seemed like that patient benefited.
Yep.
I'm sure that's not rare or unique either.
Yeah.
From your perspective in general, if you're starting a patient out on olaparib, what would you say, you know, whether it's in the recurrent or primary setting, maybe there's some difference, but in general, what are you expecting is the likelihood that you're going to have to do some kind of dose modification or delay, you know, not necessarily stop it, but you're going to have to do something as opposed to patient just cruises through without anything like that happening.
The expectation with olaparib, and this has been demonstrated in SOLO-1 and SOLO-2, is that the vast majority of patients, you know, when you look at them at 1 year or 2 year out, are still going to be on their starting dose. So you see about a 30% drop off over time for a variety of reasons that patients require a dose modification, usually just one or two. Remember, olaparib's dosed twice daily, so you have a couple opportunities to dose modify, but it's usually just one level dose modification. So roughly 70% of patients are on their starting dose kind of years down the road, and 30-ish percent require some sort of a dose modification. So it's not rare, and I think you have to be mindful of it, but it's not an expectation that your patient's going to need a modification.
That's interesting. Another issue in terms of tolerability toxicity issues that came out, if you remember, there was a case of a patient who was on rucaparib and had just started, was doing fine, but came in and her creatinine had gone from 0.86 to 1.6. And the doc was mentioning, well, you know, we know you see this with rucaparib and we know that it's not really an indication of renal dysfunction. But her question was, like, how far do you have to work a patient up? Do you have to do anything? Do you hold the drug? And I think actually you were the one who commented on her case in the meeting. Maybe you can summarize how you approach this pretty common situation, I would guess.
It's very common with rucaparib and olaparib. It's more common with rucaparib, but you see creatinine changes with olaparib as well. So those two, it's not unique to rucaparib. You'll see changes in creatinine on rucaparib like 90% of the time, but it only changes by a grade like 20 or 30% of the time. And it's usually grade 1, maybe to grade 2, or you're normal and you get to grade 1. So these are very low grade changes. I think that when you see that happen, you have to use clinical common sense with your patient. You know, I usually would just get a renal ultrasound and make sure I didn't have some new, you know, lymph node blocking a ureter. I do things just to reassure myself that I wasn't sitting on someone who was progressing, but usually the patients feel fine. And so you're relatively reassured by that. And if it's related to the rucaparib or the olaparib and you continue the dose, the creatinine kind of bumps up and then it stays. It's not this continual climb through the stratosphere. If that's happening, there's something wrong and it's probably not related to the drug. They probably have some sort of renal injury or obstruction. So it kind of bumps up and it does so relatively quickly and then it just stays there. So if that's happening, honestly, I'm pretty comfortable just watching it. When you stop the drug, it comes back down. If you really want to reassure yourself, Dr. Rob Coleman has kind of a single institution response to this that he's getting ready to publish, but they look at kind of a nuclear renal scan and just get a sense of the GFR, and the GFR is completely normal. So even though you have this bump in creatinine, their GFR reflects their original creatinine, and so you can be reassured by that as well. And he's going to have that coming out relatively soon. So that'll be a resource for providers, I think. But I don't think you need to go crazy with the workup. You just need to pay attention to the trajectory of the change of the creatinine and recognize that with rucaparib and olaparib, it's low-grade changes that level off, and that's the drug, and you can just keep treating. If it continues to rise or is in this setting of other symptoms, it needs to be worked up.
So the last question I want to reflect back on was, I think, the one that I heard the most, which was, what about a PARP inhibitor after progression on a PARP inhibitor? And, you know, this is a common issue throughout oncology. One of the docs brought up breast cancer, where you go from hormone therapy, hormone, you know, people respond. And yet I really hadn't heard much information one way or the other. I sort of figured it probably wouldn't work with PARP. When I asked people, they would sort of generally say they don't know. I'm curious where we are today, because I saw some data, I guess it was your group who presented at SGO. That was the first time I think I've seen anything of people responding to one after another.
Yep. That's my fellow, Dr. Katie Essel, did that. It is the first time it's been reported. So that paper will be coming out. I'm very proud of her. It's a small data set, multi-institution, and we just really looked at patients who had received a prior PARP inhibitor, had at least two lines of PARP inhibition, and looked at what happened when they got it again. And really all we can say from that little study is that we did see patients respond to the second PARP, and they were primarily BRCA-positive patients who had received PARP inhibitor as part of frontline therapy, all of them on a clinical trial, you know, years prior. So they were not patients who had progressed on a prior PARP.
Right.
So that's all we can say right now, is that we did see responses. There's going to be another small data set coming out from the Quadra study soon, and so I can't comment on that data, but they allowed prior PARP to come onto Quadra, and so they're going to present, BJ Reimel from Cedars-Sinai is going to present that data in an upcoming meeting, looking at responses in patients who'd received a prior PARP. But really, the most important trial to answer that question is the OREO trial, which is taking patients who'd been exposed to a prior PARP, who are still sensitive to platinum or eligible for platinum, they get reinduced and respond, which is our most important clinical predictive biomarker for response to PARP, is responding to platinum. So you're picking out your patients who respond and then randomizing them to olaparib or placebo in that recurrent setting. And we'll see what the responses are. There's really a very recent rapid emergence of data trying to evaluate why patients develop PARP resistance. Dr. Liz Swisher's group just published on detection of BRCA reversion mutations from blood samples, from circulating tumor DNA, and that detection of those reversion mutations predicts resistance to treatment with rucaparib. So you could see that sort of a, if that's validated in at least BRCA patients, you could see that being used as a selection for if you're going to retreat someone with a PARP inhibitor in the future. There's many mechanisms of PARP resistance that we know of, sort of how we test for them and how that informs whether or not we reuse a PARP inhibitor is sort of the next big elephant in the room in terms of clinical questions. And those studies are actually being designed. So I do think there's a role for PARP after PARP. Certainly patients who were on SOLO-1 and got 2 years and came off, and hopefully they never recur. But if they recur 5 years later, why wouldn't I use a PARP again? If I could test her for resistance by that point, that would make it even better. But I do think we're going to use PARP after PARP in certain populations, but we're going to have to define them. It's an exciting time, but the trials are coming.
We're just planning a lung cancer conference. We're talking about checkpoint after checkpoint. So adjuvant durvalumab, what do you do on relapse? And actually, the case that sparked the discussion was a patient of one of these docs who was on the GOG early stage solo one kind of trial with veliparib, but the recurrence was like 3 years later. So to me, that's more like re-challenge rather than, you know, as you were saying, PARP progression.
Right. Your tumor didn't fail the PARP inhibitor. It didn't progress while you were on the PARP inhibitor. So my sense is that's going to be a very different population than someone that progresses during a PARP inhibitor. But even so, you know, if she responds to platinum again, does that mean she's not going to respond to PARP?
Right.
Bevacizumab is a completely different drug. But the MITO-MANGO study, which looked at Bev after Bev, if you'd asked me, I would have said the patients who progressed on Bev aren't going to get any benefit, and the patients who didn't progress while on Bev are still going to get benefit. And both groups benefited equally well, and I was very surprised by that. So sometimes our presumptions are proven wrong when we actually do well-designed clinical trials. So this is a question I think we are going to need to answer quickly, because PARP inhibitors are moving to the front line
right.
in a lot of patients. So they're going to be asking us that question, and we're going to have some answers that are based on science rather than empiricism, but we'll see what we can figure out.
And of course, we've had continued trastuzumab on progression and metastatic breast cancer forever. It's another kind of model that sort of fits into that general category. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special audio spinoff program developed from a satellite symposium held at the Society of Gynecologic Oncology's 2019 meeting.